Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
So, Alan, I hear you made it through quite the obstacle course to be with us here today.
My car, my trusty Subaru, which I love so much, my cherry red Subaru Outback, it decided to turn on me. The trunk refused to open, and it would just beep. And it was terrible because it got stuck in the closed position, but it thinks it's open. And when the trunk is open and you start to try to drive, the car beeps at you, which is ordinarily good. But if the trunk is closed and the car just beeps at you with this incessant like beep, 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 beep. And it's been doing this for 3 days now, but it will stop beeping after like 30 seconds of driving. But if you stop, it'll start beeping again. So my wife and I have been like planning out our routes for the last 3 days in terms of like, what are the stop signs that we feel comfortable kind of rolling through? And so finally it was.
Are you admitting to traffic violations on a podcast?
I would say they were very safe rolls through, and only when there was clearly no traffic. Come on. Who among us has not roll through a stop sign?
This is like the movie Speed with Keanu Reeves, except
it does have a little bit of that vibe to that. I will also say, because Alan does not live here in Washington, D.C., the stop sign camera capital of the world, he does not run the same risk of very large tickets for rolling through stop signs that the residents of the District of Columbia do.
Just to be clear, when I say rolling through, I mean, you know, drive at 2 miles an hour, because I think like if you can get to 2 miles an hour, the car thinks you haven't stopped and therefore will not restart beeping. But I fixed the problem. It turns out they had to replace the widget in the sprocket with the thingamajiggum or whatever. And now I can stop at stop signs like a law abiding and not crazy becoming American.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Rational Security. I am one of your co-hosts, Quinta Jurassic, thrilled to be in the virtual jungle studio with my other co-host, Ellen Rosenstein.
Hello.
And we are flying Scotless this week. Our fearless leader, Scott Anderson, has abandoned us. I am taking the co-host chair, or the host chair. I'm first among co-hosts. And we are delighted to be joined by the one and only Molly Reynolds.
Hi, guys. It's good to be back.
Yeah, you're going to be coming back a lot in the next couple of months, Molly. Yeah. Get used to it.
Exactly. We're discussing two Congress topics this week. And so we could not do that without you, Molly. And indeed, thanks to the one and only Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, we are calling this the We Need to Talk About Kevin Again edition, because we're pretty sure that we have already used that joke, but we're gonna drive it into the ground. And that leads me to the three topics in this week's news. So the first topic we'll be discussing, what is impeachment really? Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, has announced an impeachment inquiry against President Biden, seemingly with the goal of finding something to impeach him over. Will this do anything to hold back the slavering hordes of the GOP far right from coming for McCarthy's speakership? Our second topic is the investigation of the investigation of Donald Trump. House Judiciary Committee Chairman and fearless Trump defender Representative Jim Jordan has fired back against Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis over the Georgia state indictment of Donald Trump, announcing that he's planning to investigate Willis for engaging in what he terms a politically motivated prosecution. Willis has responded by accusing Jordan of seeking to obstruct a Georgia criminal proceeding. What kind of authority, if any, does Congress actually have to conduct this kind of oversight? And for our third topic, we are moving beyond the first branch of government to discuss, of course, Elon Musk once again. A new biography by Walter Isaacson has sparked some controversy thanks to Isaacson's description of a decision by Musk to turn off Starlink coverage near Crimea to block a Ukrainian maneuver there over the course of the war. Isaacson has, to some extent, walked back his own reporting on this, but the incident still raises questions about Musk's influence and power on the global stage and his ability as a private actor to shape the course of war. So for our first topic, Alan, let me hand it over to you.
So as I was telling Molly before we started recording, one of the things that I love whenever Molly makes an appearance on Rational Security, beyond, of course, her expertise and her wit and just general delightful smile, is that because Molly Reynolds knows literally everything there is to know about Congress, it makes my job as the person introducing these topics very simple, because I can just turn to Molly and say, hey, Molly, so what's going on here? So, Molly, what's going on here? What exactly is it that Kevin McCarthy did? My understanding is that usually when the House wants to impeach the president, there's an actual vote by the House to start an impeachment inquiry, and that Kevin McCarthy, as recently as 2 weeks ago, said that that was going to be how it was going to be. And then yet, in the last, you know, on Tuesday, he just directed the House to begin an impeachment inquiry, whatever that means. So what does that mean, and why did he do it?
Sure. So yes, we're recording this on Wednesday. Earlier this week, Kevin McCarthy had a press conference, and he said that he was directing relevant House committees to open an impeachment inquiry into President Biden. This is, in a lot of ways, very similar to a press conference that Nancy Pelosi held in September of 2019, doing exactly the same thing. Notably, several weeks after Pelosi's version of this press conference, the House did have a formal vote to open an impeachment inquiry in the first impeachment of President Trump. All of the reporting this time around indicates that Republicans do not plan to do that. I think in large part because it is not at all clear that they have the votes within the Republican conference to adopt a resolution formally starting an impeachment inquiry. There are a number of folks who have said publicly that they are not convinced that it's the right thing to do at this juncture. And then just given the number of House Republicans who represent districts that Joe Biden won in 2020, it certainly would be a heavy political lift if McCarthy actually brought a resolution on impeachment, on an impeachment inquiry to the floor. So there are sort of a couple questions that flow from this. One is, does it matter? Like, does it matter what Kevin McCarthy did yesterday is unlikely to involve a vote of the full House? And this is, as you might expect, sort of a complicated question. On one hand, there's a Lawfare piece that I wrote with our former colleague Margaret Taylor in 2019 on this question. There are a number of powers that House committees now have as kind of a matter of course, particularly around subpoenas, that in previous decades, they did not have kind of inherently as part of the rules of the House. And so it used to be that if a House committee wanted to do a really vigorous investigation that involved issuing a lot of subpoenas, they needed particular authorization from the House to do that. That's no longer true. Now, if a House committee wants to issue a subpoena, it doesn't need to go to the full House to do that. That power has evolved in the House over time. And so on one level, there are lots of reasons why back in the day, you would have needed a special resolution to authorize an impeachment inquiry that you no longer need because House committees just have more investigative powers than they used to. So on the other hand, there is this argument that somehow impeachment and impeachment as started by a resolution with a full vote of the House is somehow different from regular oversight. And there is a OLC opinion that was released or kind of drafted in January 2020 that makes this argument that says that the House does actually have to have a formal impeachment vote on a resolution authorizing an impeachment inquiry for the subpoenas that flow from that to be valid, because again, they are somehow qualitatively different than regular subpoenas. I am skeptical of that argument, but it is out there. And so there is, I think, an open question as to, like, does this matter? So that's kind of a substantive discussion. And then, like, politically, why does it matter that Kevin McCarthy came out and did this? He thinks that this might help mollify some of his more reactionary members on the right end of his conference. I think we saw pretty quickly that does not necessarily appear to be true, that they are still unhappy with various things about Kevin McCarthy and how he is leading the House Republicans. And so it's not clear to me that if part of the choice to announce this week was to try and bolster his political standing, it's not really clear to me that that's working.
Yeah, so there's a lot in there and a lot to draw out. I want to focus for a moment on the allusion or the reference you made to the OLC opinion released back in during the first Trump impeachment, in which DOJ, as you said that absent a official House vote beginning an impeachment inquiry, these subpoenas sort of are null and void or whatever. This has been going the rounds in the press as kind of a ha-ha against Republicans because, an opinion from a Trump OLC is now going to help Biden. And the idea, I think, is that in the absence of a House vote, the Biden officials should not feel compelled to cooperate with whatever that these House committees do in terms of investigating Hunter Biden and Joe Biden and all of that sort of stuff. And I actually am curious if you think that helps or hurts the impeachment effort, because on the one hand, you could say, well, obviously, if the White House doesn't cooperate, then the impeachment inquiry doesn't get the facts it needs, and so that harms the impeachment inquiry and helps Biden. But you could also say this isn't actually about like collecting facts. This is about waging this weird political fight. And if the Biden administration has to choose between, or if the Biden administration decides to take advantage of this opinion from the Trump OLC and not cooperate, it actually kind of almost helps the impeachment because then they can remain fact-free, which is kind of where they're most comfortable, and can still yell and scream about how the White House isn't cooperating. I mean, I guess the more general question is, like, should we even think about this as a normal impeachment, given that it doesn't seem to be trying to do the things that normal impeachment is trying to do, which is like figure out what actually happened? Even though I should also say, like, to all the Biden apologists, like, the Hunter Biden thing like does not seem great as a general matter, even though I don't think it rises anywhere near an impeachable offense.
Yeah, I can't believe that we elected Hunter Biden as the president.
Touché, Jurassic.
No, but seriously, just to add one point onto that, I mean, Molly, I'm interested in what you think about this. I've been kind of irritated at the horse race political coverage of all this because it seems like it's devolved very quickly into what does this mean for McCarthy, which is like an interesting and important question for reasons we'll talk about. But like typically when someone is impeached, there's like a reason. Whatever you think of the reason, there's like a thing that they did. Whereas in this, it seems like it's vibes, and the vibes are not even particularly well defined, right? The vibes are like Hunter Biden engaged in some influence peddling. Question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark.
Yeah, so there's a lot here. Just like Alan said, there's a lot in my initial comments. I think one, in like slight defense of the kind of horse racy coverage of this, I mean, I think part of why the coverage has gone in that direction immediately is because fundamentally, like, I read this as being about Kevin McCarthy's political problems. Like, part of why this is happening now is because I think Kevin McCarthy is trying to solve a political problem. So we should probably talk about whether or not that's going to work, particularly because the political problem is actually ultimately a problem about funding the government, which is something about which we and everyone else do and should care deeply. That's one thing I'd note. The other thing I'd raise is, like, you both used a version of the phrase like normal impeachment, or usually when we have impeachments. And I think we need to take a step back and think about, well, like, how has this evolved over time? and like the approach to the impeachment power. There is a, I'll point folks to a piece on Lawfare from last November by our collective dear friend, Brian Cult, called We Live in an Age of Feudal Impeachments. And that's feudal, like unsuccessful, not like of the feudal system.
That would be kind of, that would be kind of awesome though.
Yeah, I don't know what that would look like.
The peasants put the baron on trial.
Yeah. But anyway, so, but this is one of the arguments that Brian makes, essentially, that we've had this evolution because of our political system in how Congress thinks about its impeachment power to the point where, like, maybe what we thought of as normal impeachments pre-Trump may just not be a world that we're living in anymore. And the last thing I'll say to come back to sort of Alan's first question about how should we think about the OLC opinion is that I think fundamentally, as an institutional matter, like the House should not care what OLC should not care is probably an overstatement, but the House is not bound by what OLC thinks about this, and they should continue to pursue their over. Like, even if I think that this impeachment inquiry is largely in bad faith and fact free, like institutionally, the House does not have to listen to the Department of Justice in how it organizes its rules for and processes for proceeding on impeachment. And while I think there is an open question of like what the courts would say about this if folks tried to start litigating it, the House under the Democrats like did not proceed in line with this OLC opinion. And like there's no institutionally, I don't see why a Republican-led House should either, because this for me a lot of this is a matter of like congressional power.
So yeah, I mean, I want to go back to this point that you made, referencing Cult's excellent argument about futile with a T impeachments, and just saying this may be a new normal. And you know, I sort of recall arguments that were made by skeptics of the first Trump impeachment, and you know, a lot of those were in bad faith, but there were some like good faith, you know, concerns about the first impeachment. Fair enough, and you know, a lot of the argument boiled down to, look, this is a slippery slope. You know, if the Democrats impeach Trump, then the next time the Republicans are in power, they're going to impeach the Democratic president and so on and so forth. And, you know, if I was one of those folks right now, I would be feeling pretty good. I mean, I'd be feeling bad for the country, but I'd be feeling pretty good in my prognostication. You know, on the other hand, you have to run the counterfactual. Like, is it really the case that if the Democrats had not impeached Trump, we wouldn't be here? Or even if you do run the counterfactual, you still have to ask, well, maybe impeaching Trump was ultimately worth it. And we're just going to have to live in a world where we have constant impeachments. And like there are some quote unquote real ones and some quote unquote fake ones. And we're just going to have to deal with both of those things being called impeachments. I'm kind of curious where you stand on the tit for tat dynamics here.
Yeah. So I think and this is not unique to this impeachment question, but I think it is often a fool's errand to say if one party did not do X at time T, the other party would not have done Y at time T plus one. As someone who, to take this on a little bit of a tangent, someone who spends quite a lot of my life thinking and talking about the Senate filibuster, this is a continuous discussion. Like, if Democrats hadn't gone nuclear in 2013, would Republicans have gone nuclear for Gorsuch in 2017? And I think, to me, history tells us that a party will do a thing when they have the votes and think it's important enough to do the thing, and they won't do the thing when they don't have the votes or don't think it's important enough. And so that's sort of how I read this. I mean, again, as someone who just like puts this in a broader context of how parties interact in Congress, I do think this notion that we have less clarity in this particular moment around like what it is that Biden is alleged to have done that would rise to the level of impeachment is an important distinction. But the other, and then I guess I'll just say one last thing, is that I think sometimes we can also forget that like it took House Democrats much longer in 2019 than many people both within the House Democratic Caucus and outside of the House Democratic Caucus wanted it to get to, Quinta is raising her hand, to get to.
So many weeks of outrage.
To get to impeachment. And for me, one of the things that really underlines is the way in which impeachment is fundamentally a political question. And I don't mean that in like a pejorative way. I mean that in a like, you have to get the votes. But so at the end of the day, like impeachment is what and when a majority of the House of Representatives wants to pursue it. And I think we can ask questions about whether it is constitutionally and substantively different than other powers of the House. But it's still fundamentally a question about what does a majority want to do and when.
Yeah. So speaking of majorities, I mean, there's some weird dynamics here, right? Because as you said, McCarthy's jumping into this without a vote. My understanding is that probably the reason that he hasn't wanted a vote is that it's not totally clear that he would get a majority.
Yeah, certainly not clear that he would get to a majority without making some part of his caucus, including the part that is most electorally vulnerable, quite angry along the way.
Right. And so, and then there's this additional question of, you know, what's going to happen if they engage in an impeachment inquiry, however we're defining both of those words, what ends up happening if they do decide that at some point they need to, you know, move forward with impeachment itself or some other set of processes that are related that will require a bunch of Republicans to take really, really awkward, uncomfortable votes. Like, does this actually solve any problems? Or because it seems more like it just creates like 10 more problems.
And just to add a quick question on that, I mean, is impeachment inevitable? I mean, Quinta's question suggests that, well, maybe at some point we'll have to think about it. You know, there's another school of thought that's, you know, flying around Twitter or X, as it's called. I'm not going to call it X. I'm calling it Twitter forever. And look, at some point, it's going to go bankrupt and then someone will buy it and obviously rebrand it Twitter again. So I'm just going to keep calling it Twitter. There's a lot of speculation on Twitter that, like, at this point, the House has essentially committed itself to impeaching Joe Biden. And I'm curious if you think that's true.
Yeah, I mean, so it is. I think we're going to talk a little bit more about Jim Jordan in a
dear listener. We will.
But I'll admit that it is kind of hard to imagine if this comes to the Judiciary Committee, Jim Jordan just saying, you know what? I'm going to let this pitch go by. Like, not going to swing at it. So that is,
I feel like that's the wrong one sports ball metaphor given Jim Jordan. He has to be like, this is the punt I will whiff. I don't know. Isn't he do football sports ball?
No, he's a wrestler.
He's a wrestler.
Oh, he's a wrestler.
Who reportedly enabled sexual abuse.
Well, I knew that part.
Despite having grown up in a part of the country where high school wrestling is a big deal, I will admit ignorance to like wrestling terms. So I'm not going to try to work a metaphor there. So I think that's a real consideration here. Like, will Jordan just kind of let this die? I think generally one other dynamic that's really important to consider in the context of the impeachment inquiry specifically, and then in the general operations of the House Republican Conference, including their efforts to avoid a government shutdown, is that there's some part of the conference whose sort of whole reason for being is to be mad about things. Sometimes that anger is directed at Kevin McCarthy. And so you sometimes hear folks criticize both parties for not taking smaller wins when they can get them because they want to keep issues alive for campaign purposes. And to me, there's like a little bit of that going on here too. It's like, when would they actually want to get to the point where they do the actual impeaching as opposed to just continue talking about impeachment and having hearings that they say are a part of an impeachment inquiry to like keep this issue, which they seem to care quite a lot about, on the front burner. And I don't know what the timing is. And then the last thing I'll say, because someone will want to know about this, is My least favorite discourse is the what is an impeachment inquiry actually discourse. My second least favorite discourse is can the Senate not have a trial if the House impeaches the president?
Hell yes. Let's go.
I would love a list. Can I just say, I feel like a Patreon exclusive should be just be Molly Reynolds just reading down her list of least favorite discourses.
They're all extremely niche, but they all I have a lot of feelings about them. And like the short answer to that question is, again, like the Senate, there's a whole host of ways that the Senate could probably dispense with an impeachment that came over from the House short of having a full trial if there are enough votes to do so. But it does I bring this up, though, because one of the other things you have started to see reporting on is like whether Republican senators are really jazzed about doing this. And the answer is some of them appear to be not especially excited about having to do this, in part because, and again, we can like talk a little bit more about the relationship between this and the coming possible government shutdown, is that like Republican senators by and large are more interested in like doing appropriations bills and making sure that funding to Ukraine still flows and all sorts of things. And so it doesn't seem like, at least some of them don't seem super excited about having to pursue this, either politically, substantively, or both.
So Molly, we are headed for a potential government shutdown in October. I emphasize potential because you, of course, predicted.
I won the hot take contest.
Yeah. You won the hot take contest with your prediction that there would not be a shutdown.
Would you like to amend your remarks, Dr. Reynolds, in light of the impeachment? that's my question. But sorry, could you finish your question?
Let me set this out because I do think it would be useful to sort of take stock of where we are in terms of the potential of a shutdown and why McCarthy seemingly thinks that this move might help him avert that, and if it actually will, if this kicks the can down the road, essentially how these two things interact.
Yeah. So I think it's important to remember that the same people in the House Republican Conference who are agitating most for impeachment, I shouldn't say exactly the same, many of those same people are also the same people who are agitating the most for a government shutdown. And their minds, like, or I should say, their willingness to vote for something that could actually pass the Senate and be signed by Joe Biden that would avoid a government shutdown, like, those votes are not going to change because Kevin McCarthy said they're going to do an impeachment inquiry. Like, they were never going to vote for a continuing resolution to keep the government open past October 1st that the Senate would also vote for and that Biden would also sign. And they're not going to do so now just because Kevin McCarthy said we're having an impeachment inquiry. And so it is possible that one consideration here is he thinks that if he is going to have to make that part of his conference angry to keep the government open, that perhaps opening an impeachment inquiry helps make it less likely that they try to come after him as speaker. I am skeptical that their efforts to actually depose him as speaker would work. And so that really just gets us back to, like, he's going to have to do something that makes a lot of his conference unhappy and to keep the government from shutting down in 3 weeks, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And just the question is, like, is he willing to do that or is he willing to shut down the government? And I think I still fundamentally think the answer is he would prefer not to shut down the government. He would prefer not to take that blame, in part because I think he probably realizes that what the pro-shutdown part of his conference wants, like, they're never going to get. There's no win for them here, in part because part of their whole reason for being is that they want to be mad about things. And, like, they're not going to stop wanting to be mad about things because Kevin McCarthy opened an impeachment inquiry.
It really does feel like someone needs to buy the entire House of Representatives a subscription to Headspace or the Calm app. Like, they just need some more mindfulness.
Rational Security is sponsored by.
Yeah, we'll take it. We'll take it, guys.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Well, I think this is a good transition. We're going from dysfunction in Congress to great, more dysfunction in Congress. Let's talk about the quote unquote oversight of the Fulton County prosecution. So again, listeners, you may be aware that there's this little insignificant, tiny, not all important criminal prosecution going on in Fulton County of Donald Trump and his chief of staff and a bunch more defendants. And this has made some people on Capitol Hill very upset, including the heretofore mentioned Jim Jordan, who is the head of the House Judiciary Committee. Last month, he announced that he would be opening an investigation into the investigation of Donald Trump in Georgia. He sent a letter to Fulton County DA Fani Willis, accusing her of politicizing and just bringing a political prosecution. And then Fani Willis hit back in a very strongly worded letter accusing Jim Jordan of obstructing the prosecution of Donald Trump and defending the conduct of defending her own conduct and that of her office. So the first question, and again, right back to you, Molly, what in principle can Jim Jordan and the House Judiciary Committee do either in a quote unquote oversight role, if you want to sort of treat them as good faith actors, or in an obstruction role, if you don't want to treat them as good faith actors, of the Fani Willis prosecution or Fani Willis's prosecution of Donald Trump, or just of state prosecutions generally? It's sort of unclear what levers these people can pull, except for writing really mean letters to one another.
I guess a couple things. So one, as I understand it, there is like Fani Willis's office gets a little bit of like federal grant money to do things. So like one, if what they were trying to do is really make her life difficult, like they could always pursue, you know, provisions in the appropriations bills that they can't pass that would cut off funding to the Fulton County DA's office,
Love the shade that you just like throw in there, right? If you'd be a quick listener, appropriations, what they can't pass. It's awesome.
I mean, it's true. Fundamentally, like one of the biggest challenges here, again, to like take this out a little bit, is that they have part of why they have no leverage in the negotiations over avoiding a government shutdown generally is because they have up till now been largely unable to pass their own appropriations bills. But anyway, so that's like one specific thing I would say. More generally, there is this just, I think, idea that Jordan can try and make Willis's life difficult, can send her letters asking for information if she chooses not to comply, can subpoena her, can try to take her to court. The exact parameters of what he can ask for and what a court would say has a, to use Quinta's favorite term, legitimate legislative purpose as part of their oversight function is, I think, open. We know that if they were to try and litigate this, it would take forever. Also, Quinta can tell you that I've been talking repeatedly over the past week or so about the amount of time it took the Department of Justice to successfully prosecute Peter Navarro for contempt of Congress. The answer is 459 days. But so that, again, that's just to say that like, even if they were to actually try and litigate this, it would take a really long time, whether Willis would have to comply with the subpoena, because whether a court would say that like the House Judiciary Committee has a legitimate legislative purpose in trying to oversee the activities of a district attorney's office in the state of Georgia. I don't know, but I think that's the way to think about it.
Yeah, I actually was, in fact, about to talk about legitimate legislative purpose. So for listeners who aren't as single-mindedly obsessed with this as me and Molly, this, of course, traces back to the Trump v. Mazars decision.
There's a long line of jurisprudence that says that congressional committee's oversight power has to have a legislative purpose. That phrase and concept took on a particular role in Trump v. Mazars, but that is not its origin story.
Yes, very, very fair. I guess I would say Mazars is kind of the point where that phrase starts to have a little bite and committees have to start demonstrating what their legislative purpose is rather than just kind of waving their hands around and declaring that it is so, for good or for ill, right? And so as with that OLC memo that we were talking about, this is a little bit of kind of turnabout as fair play, right? Where the institutional authorities and limitations that maybe Democrats were very enthused about under Trump can now get flipped on their head and encourage and or create problems for Republicans now that they're in control of Congress. I will say it's a little hard for me to see, given Mazars, given everything, how much information Jim Jordan is going to be able to get about an ongoing prosecution. I mean, never say never, but Alan, do you have any sense of that? I will totally admit that I'm talking kind of off the top of my head here, but my sense is that the ability of Congress to kind of start mucking around in an ongoing prosecution by a state government would raise like serious federalism questions, right?
I mean, it would raise serious federalism questions. I mean, to be honest, I think largely the issue is just, as Molly alluded to, that this would be decided in litigation and that would take forever. But let me use this question to actually ask a question of my own that I think it segues into, which is, you know, at this point, we've talked mostly about the Jim Jordan side of things. I actually want to talk a little bit about the Fannie Willis side of things, because I will say, and maybe this is a bit of a spicy take, I did not love her response. I get where she's coming from. And again, I do not believe Jim Jordan is a good faith actor. At the same time, I don't think the use of the term obstruction was coincidental on her part, given that obstruction of justice is one of the things that at least the federal prosecution is charging Trump with, and it's just sort of generally in the air. I'm not that comfortable, frankly, with a state prosecutor, you know, accusing, not explicitly, but at least implicitly, a congressperson and the head of the Judiciary Committee of a crime for asking for information about what is one of the most important and influential criminal cases in American history. Even, to be clear, let's stipulate, right, that Jim Jordan is not exactly a model for, you know, good faith, disinterested public service. You know, I have always been a little bit uneasy with the idea that state prosecutions should ever be permitted of, you know, the president of the United States. I mean, again, I'm not implacably opposed to that. And I think actually we're very lucky in that it was Fannie Willis, of all people, who is bringing this case, because I think, like, you know, of the many different kinds of state prosecutions, I think Fannie Willis is very much a straight shooter and has a lot of integrity. But, you know, call me unhappy with the tone of this. And, you know, Quinta, tell me if I'm being sort of too prissy about this and if I'm just sort of over-rotating on the tone policing. Or if my grumpiness here, again, even if at the end of the day, like, look, obviously I'm not going to sit here and defend Jim Jordan. Like, that's, you know, even both sides Rosenstein can't do that. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, right? So I think part of what we may be encountering is that the dynamic, at least that I'm familiar with in terms of prosecutors sending a kind of brushback pitch to Congress, tends to be from DOJ, from the special counsel's office, right? And those are not elected prosecutors. There are different norms about how one behaves and the kind of rhetoric one uses. And, you know, folks at DOJ, I'm sure, would like to think that that is in part what makes them superior to their state counterparts. But whether or not you accept that, I think that that is part, you know, like, I would expect some kind of letter from, you know, Jack Smith to be very settled and sober and not include things like those who wish to avoid felony charges in Fulton County, Georgia, should not commit felonies in Fulton County, Georgia, which is a line that Willis includes. I mean,
It's a good line.
She's not wrong. She also at one point suggests that Jim Jordan can purchase a guide to the Georgia RICO statute for a cool $249 because he is not a member of the Georgia bar.
Fonnie Willis is not without rhetorical talent.
It's like, it is kind of funny. It definitely does feel like she's like playing to, you know, resistance social media. Now, she is an elected prosecutor. So the dynamic, just from like a structural position, the dynamic is different there. I will say I am a little uncomfortable with the sort of like, you know, enthusiasm for Willis among certain quarters, given what I would argue is her likely overly expansive use of the Georgia RICO statute in other contexts and the truly appalling situation in the Fulton County Jail, which she's done very little, if anything, I think, to fix. And so to the extent that this feeds into kind of like that whole vibe, I'm a little uncomfortable with it. But I do, I guess I would say instinctively, I agree with you, but intellectually, I can understand why it's coming from a different place. I don't know. Molly, do you have thoughts?
Yeah, I guess I'll just add two things. The one is this, like, I think one of the things that Quinta, you in particular, are picking up on is, again, as I was saying before in the thinking about impeachments, is like a fundamentally political question. Like, this is also a fundamentally a question of politics. And there are, as you pointed out, an interaction here, Quinta, of like politics and norms that is producing, I think, some of what we're seeing. The other thing to sort of draw out your hypothetical comparison between this letter and a similar brushback letter that might come from the Department of Justice, I also think it's worth remembering that, you know, in Georgia, the whole reason that these people are being prosecuted is because they tried to overturn the results of the election, like in the state. And so you can imagine why someone who is an elected official in a state where a whole bunch of people allegedly came in and tried to overturn the results of your presidential election in various ways might be like differently angry about what have their strategy shaped differently is probably a better way to put it by those circumstances.
It would be very amusing to me if Fonnie Willis becomes a progressive prosecutor icon after all of this.
Oh, she already is.
It's hilarious. Oh, sweet, sweet progressives never learn.
It makes me really mad, honestly. And I think that we got ourselves into this situation in part by doing things like, you know, allowing former prosecutors like, you know, Comey and Preet Bharara to write memoirs about how great the justice system is without engaging seriously with the critiques of their own actions, right? But that's a different conversation for a different time. Anyway, from the first branch of government to the Godhead who rules us all, from Mars, where he has not, in fact, launched satellites, despite what Walter Isaacson seems to think. So, Elon Musk, you've heard of him. There is a new biography out by Walter Isaacson, and the book includes a passage that has some pretty explosive information, although to some extent it was reported at the time, saying that last year Musk had ordered the Starlink service to be turned off near Crimea to essentially prevent Ukraine from launching an attack on an underwater drone attack on a Russian fleet there. When this was published in an excerpt, it created quite a hubbub and actually led to Isaacson walking back his statement by saying that it wasn't that the service was enabled and Musk turned it off. It was that it had already been turned off and the Ukrainians didn't realize that or asked him to turn it back on and he refused. So setting aside the question of accuracy and biography, because I think we can go down many, many rabbit holes there. I do think that this, you know, raises a lot of questions on topic that we talked about the other week when it comes to the particular and unique power of Musk as this figure who is not just wealthy, not just in control of a major social media platform, but has a pretty extraordinary influence over global connectivity and communications and how that enables him to kind of play a role in the prosecution of a major war. So I believe that Isaacson excerpt has it. There's a bit where Musk kind of texts a Ukrainian minister and says, "You should really think about negotiating with Russia." Like, thanks, man. We appreciate it. So, Alan, what do you think about this? You're currently sitting with your head in your hands.
So I'm sitting with my head in my hands because I'm about to do something that I don't want to do, which is defend Elon Musk. So I want to zoom out for a second.
Oh, and just no.
Talk. Oh, no, indeed. I just want to talk about what I'm almost certainly unoriginally going to call Musk derangement syndrome. Right. So everyone has heard of this problem of, quote unquote, Trump derangement syndrome, which is the idea that, you know, particularly, let's say, on the left, one can get so wrapped up in one's hatred of Donald Trump, very understandably so, that one just loses some basic critical faculties. I really think that there's a danger of this happening with respect to Elon Musk. I am not a fan of Elon Musk. I think that he has run Twitter into the ground and is just, you know, doing like really terrible things to our public discourse. I think he just mouths off about stuff he has no idea about, and that his, thoughts on the Russia-Ukraine war are not helpful and ones that I do not associate with. But I do think there's a sense in which people's revulsion for a lot of Musk really can turn off their critical faculties and make him into this sort of like super villain that is, I think, neither true nor is frankly helpful to think about in that way. Let's talk about the sort of specific issue at hand, which is this question of what he did with respect to Starlink in Ukraine, and in particular, Ukraine's ability to conduct certain kinds of strikes on Russia. So unfortunately, I think the facts actually matter here quite a bit. I think there actually is a very meaningful difference. You know, maybe it's like maybe this is just sort of casuistic and a sort of trolley car difference, but I think there actually is a difference between Starlink was operating a particular way, Ukraine had access to it, and then Musk decided, no, I don't want Starlink to be used by the Ukrainians in this particular attack. And so he turns it off in this particular attack. That's very, very different, right? Then Starlink was not working in a particular way, or the Ukrainians asked for more facilities, and Musk said, yeah, I'm not that interested in that, right? To be honest, I think it is, even for someone like Musk, who certainly does not lack in self-confidence or self-assuredness, I am just skeptical that he would literally disallow a particular targeting move by the Ukrainians if they already had access to Starlink. It's possible, obviously, but like Musk is fundamentally a rational business person. And so I just am doubtful of that. I also think that there is, I mean, yeah, so it's sad that
podcast is
an auditory medium. And I obviously get what Quint is talking about, given what he is doing with Twitter, right? But he certainly has some rationality in him. I think also the kind of whisperings or the sense you get from the White House is not that Musk is acting as some sort of like rogue operator pulling the strings behind the Ukraine war, and that the White House, you know, even if Musk did what he was alleged to do, would not be super unhappy with that, given that the White House is also spending a lot of its time trying to, you know, prevent Ukraine from accidentally starting World War III. So again, part of it is just this factual uncertainty. But I think the bigger problem here is this framing that like it's Musk's job to help the Ukrainians prosecute the war to the fullest possibility because he happens to have Starlink. Like, it's just not. Like, it should not be a private individual's job to engage in a decisive role in like a profound military conflict. And it's not absurd for this person to want to have as little as possible to do with this. Now, it is the case that the facts on the ground are that Musk launched a bunch of satellites into low Earth orbit, and those satellites are really helpful. And then he let Ukrainians use them. And so like, it's kind of hard for him to say, well, I don't want to have anything to do with this. But at the same time, like Musk didn't launch those satellites into low Earth orbit. Like Musk launched those satellites into low Earth orbit because he saw a business opportunity that was legitimately adding value to the world. Like Starlink is a kind of remarkable achievement in terms of global telecommunications. And it's not like any governments were competing with him, and it's not like any governments told him no. And so I think that people are just not appreciating that there is a real upside to the fact that this person has gotten to operate his businesses. Now, Twitter is not part of that upside, but Starlink, Tesla, SpaceX, these are remarkable achievements. And I'm not here to say that those remarkable achievements are due to Musk's genius. I don't know if that's true. I also don't care. But like, you know, Musk saw a way to make a lot of money by providing a lot of value to humanity, which is through these satellites, which are legitimately very useful. And like, honestly, I don't know why we're spending so much time arguing about Musk and whether Musk is giving Ukraine enough Starlink, and more just about, look, if the U.S. wants Musk to, you know, if the U.S. wants Ukraine to have some capabilities, then, you know, U.S. do that yourself or pay Musk to do that. But I don't know. I find the Musk framing all this like super frustrating.
I mean, I think that Musk has, your Freudian slip is apropos in part because Musk, like Trump, has a tendency, like he is just a black hole of conversation, right? Everything that you say about him just becomes sucked into this endless psychologizing. And I find it ultimately deeply uninteresting and profoundly sort of warped by great man theories of history that are ultimately distorting and not particularly illuminating. But I mean, the thing that I keep coming back to is there's this incredible and bizarre line in the Walter Isaacson excerpt that was published in the Post that kicked all this off, where he has a late night phone conversation with Isaacson, who's clearly thrilled by his access, by the way, and says, and I yes, quote,
Walter Isaacson is generally thrilled by his access. That is through line in his written work.
So this is Musk, quote, "How am I in this war? Starlink was not meant to be involved in wars. It was so people can watch Netflix and chill and get online for school and do good peaceful things, not drone strikes. I'm sorry." This is like Silicon Valley idiocy of, oh, I'm going to do technology and so there won't be politics anymore. You're building a global satellite network and you're surprised when someone wants to use it for a war? Are you kidding me? Like, this is a big, like, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen, man. It is baffling to me that he is acting like faux naivete. Oh, how did I end up in this position? You ended up in this position because you build a global satellite network.
So granted. And if the question is Musk's faux naivete annoying? I will happily co-sign that it is deeply annoying. And if the question is, does Silicon Valley think with a sufficient level of sophistication about its technology? I will happily co-sign anyone who says no. So all of that is true on the table. My point is just that we actually, like, In our capitalist system, for better or for worse, I happen to think for better, but it's kind of the only game in town. We rely on private individuals to build a bunch of stuff and push a technological frontier, right? And then we rely on government to come in and say, this is a really cool thing, but there's like a piece of it that's going to have real profound geopolitical ramifications. And so we're going to come in and we're going to actively regulate either through informal or probably in this case would have been informal channels. That's the way it should work. But saying, well, Musk should either have to choose between launching Starlink and then apparently having to play a non-trivial role in the war in Ukraine, or, well, he just shouldn't launch Starlink to begin with. And that's a bad choice because we want people like that to launch Starlink, even if their motives are not, you know, public-spirited, as Musk's would like us to believe that they are, but rather purely pecuniary. And that's what I find so frustrating, right? It's like, it's a good thing that Musk launched Starlink, and if there are some sort of negative, weird global externalities, like, that's fine, and the government should regulate that, and maybe Musk should lose money on that, but, like, the government has to step in at some point. But, like, this binary choice, I think, is just not a good way of developing our technological society.
I mean, I guess I would say at that point, like, yes, the government does need to step in. And the question is, does it have the tools that it needs to step in? And also, how would, you know, not just the executive, but also the courts and, yes, Molly, Congress, what would they make of this? Because I worry that, you know, this has become a serious problem. But it's also become deeply politicized because of Musk's own posturing. And so my worry would be, you know, even if we reach the point where, yes, something needs to be done about Starlink, if there were any kind of effort by the Biden administration to take action here, that it would run headlong into, you know, Jim Jordan and his cohort saying they're only going after Elon Musk because, you know, they hate free speech in America and apple pie.
Yeah, I would just, I don't have much to add here except to say that the last thing, the efforts to keep U.S. aid to Ukraine flowing needs is like a derailing of that debate by attaching Elon Musk and his politics to the question of like, what should the U.S. be doing in Ukraine? I think that there is a topic we didn't talk about when we talked about government funding is the prospects for another round of robust aid to Ukraine this fall. And I think that is, that's like another issue in this big stew of issues. And I think that it is in part being like kept on track by Mitch McConnell, for whom this seems to be very important, and he's been very successful at keeping Senate Republicans together on this issue. But I think if you are a person who cares about that, you really don't want like the Musk story getting attached to the debate over more funding for aid to Ukraine.
Well, it would not be rational security if we did not close out with some object lessons. That's me doing my best Scott Anderson impression. Molly, let me start with you.
Sure. So there is, within the Lawfare Cinematic Universe, a group, a faction of us who are quite interested in things related to the Troubles in Northern Ireland. I count Tyler at a minimum as in this camp. And so for those folks and for anyone else, I have a PBS documentary series to recommend to you that is called Once Upon a Time in Northern Ireland. Which is a, I believe it's 5 parts on the Troubles, and it is sort of through the eyes of ordinary people. It is it is both very hard to watch and very compelling, and so I recommend it to all of you.
Alan, what do you have for us?
So my recommendation is, I think, refreshingly for me, who mostly just does TV and fruit syrup recommendations. By the way, I just want to thank my other RadSec listenership. There, multiple people have emailed me in response to my last object lesson, which was about South Korean plum syrup called Chung. I've gotten like recommendations. Someone identified the plum tree in my backyard for me, so now I finally know what it is. I love the RadSec community, so thank you for this. My object lesson this week is a wonderful book. I am very late to the party. It's over a decade old now. It's from 2012, called The Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller. She wrote that and then also wrote a kind of a sort of follow-up book called Circe. Her thing is that she basically is doing kind of retellings of the Iliad and the Odyssey, but sort of in contemporary fictional form. I mean, it's amazing. I haven't read Circe yet, though that's next on my list. The Song of Achilles is a retelling of the Iliad, which is about a period of, in the Trojan War, in particular about Achilles, the great hero who refuses to fight and then ultimately is brought to fight against the Trojans by the death of his, in the Iliad, it's somewhat ambiguous, his sort of best friend Patroclus, but pretty clear is his lover. And so Miller has taken that story and done sort of a full kind of Bildungsroman from the perspective of Patroclus. And it's amazing. It's amazing. The book is amazing. It's beautifully done. It's just a wonderful introduction to the Homeric myths, but mostly just as a piece of literature. Like it moved me in a way that fiction has not moved me in some time. And so I just enormously, enormously recommend that book, whether or not you think you're interested in the Iliad or not. I suspect that for like real classic heads, there's like a ton of like fun Easter eggs woven in throughout the book that I, who have not read, you know, the classics since high school, mostly missed. But just standing on its own, it's fabulous. The Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller.
All right. And I'm also going to come in with a television recommendation. I have been watching the HBO series Telemarketers. I've only seen the first episode. There are 3 episodes and it just wrapped. And it is this incredible sort of... gonzo journalism is not quite the right descriptor, but it's about a group, a sort of scummy telemarketing company that would call folks and tell them that they were fundraising on behalf of, you know, stuff like the Fraternal Order of Police and so on, and pocket an extraordinary amount of the money. So it's a great sort of raw material for, you know, muckraking documentary. But the kind of twist, such as it is that the documentary is made by this person, Sam Lipman-Stern, who was employed by this scummy telemarketing company after he dropped out of high school because it was the only place that would give him a job, and was sort of filming throughout his time there, and essentially decides that he's going to, you know, uncover all of the shady dealings of this company and take them down. So it's this sort of fascinating mix of genuine muckraking with a sort of personal story, you know, gonzo journalism edge. And the main characters are very much part of the story, not only in their sort of outrage at the people they're working for, but also in their bumbling and less than competent sort of attempts at journalism and digging up information. I found the first episode totally gripping, and I am looking forward to continuing watching it. All right, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Rational Security is a production of Lawfare. You can visit lawfaremedia.org for our show page with links to past episodes and for our written work and the written work of other Lawfare contributors. You can follow us on X at RATL Security. And be sure to leave a rating or review. You can also sign up to become a material supporter of Lawfare on Patreon for an ad-free version of this podcast. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo. Our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan, and we are, of course, edited by the wonderful Jem Patya-Howell. On behalf of my co-host, Alan, and our special guest, Molly Reynolds, I'm Quinta Jurassic, and we'll talk to you next week. Until then, goodbye.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.